the best defense against that danger in the future will not come from law enforcement, but rather an informed and active citizenry.
Okay, so what recommendations does the report lay out?
The first is reforms to the Electoral Count Act. This would solidify a vice president's role as ceremonial. And this is part of a major spending bill that could head to President Biden's desk today. It also says it's now up to the Justice Department and courts to take the lead on criminal referrals, and that respective legal bar associations should evaluate the conduct of attorneys named in the report who should not, quote, undermine the constitutional and statutory process for peacefully transferring power in our government. This includes attorney John Eastman, who was tied to the plot to overturn the result, Kenneth Chesbrough, a central figure in the fake elector scheme, and other Trump-aligned attorneys such as Rudy Giuliani.
Okay, so Claudia, now that this investigation is done, the report is out, what are the next steps?
There are still more records to come, and plenty. Mm-hmm. For example, a few dozen witness transcripts have been shared so far by the panel, but hundreds more are expected in the coming days as the panel will sunset December 31st.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thank you much.
The U.S. just pledged nearly $2 billion in new military aid to Ukraine. The package includes a sophisticated Patriot missile battery. During this week's surprise visit to Washington and in a news conference with President Biden, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky joked through an interpreter that one might not be enough.
What's going to happen after Patriots are installed? After that, we will send another signal to President Biden that we would like to get more Patriots.
The Kremlin called the new shipment a provocative step and warned of unpredictable consequences. And some in the U.S. have expressed skepticism about both the cost and the effectiveness. Among them, retired U.S. Army Major Mike Lyons. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Major.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So Ukraine has been pleading for this kind of defense system in the face of Russia's Air Force power, its missile attacks. Why are you worried about providing this to them?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I don't think it's enough in that the Patriot missile system would only protect, let's say, one-fifth of the landmass of Ukraine. The size of Ukraine is very large. And this will create a false sense of security for them in some ways. They'll have to decide to put it only in a certain location, likely in Kyiv, where it will protect just the capital, versus critical infrastructure where the Russians are going to target most of their cruise missiles now, I think, going forward with this system in place. It's the most sophisticated one in the world. So if we're going to give them this system, we have to give them enough where they can at least protect their own country with.
So is the answer to give them more?
Likely Patriot missiles, which are defensive in nature. Now, there is still risk here. The risk is that these Patriot missiles will acquire a Russian target of an airplane, let's say, a fighter plane, and they chase. And what that means is they could potentially cross over the border between Ukraine and Russia and acquire a target in Russian territory. I think that's what America is concerned about. The administration thinks that if U.S. military power is used to acquire Russian targets across over Russia, I think that's a level of escalation that they're really uncomfortable with.
And what could happen if a missile were to chase into Russian airspace like that?
And if it acquires that target, you now have potentially American military hardware using against Russian military hardware over Russia. Russia could say that's an act of war, and they could likely escalate, perhaps launch a missile against known U.S. forces that are in Poland or other NATO countries that are there. So it could lead to an escalation. I think that's what the administration is concerned about.
Now, in your view, though, do you think that the Patriot system should just not be given to Ukraine at all, or what's the answer here?
No, I think the system is appropriate. It's still fundamentally defensive in nature, and that's the issue here. All of the systems that we've provided to them are defensive. They're not necessarily going to help Ukraine win on the ground in particular. They need tanks. They need F-16s. They need other offensive platforms, long-range missile systems, another example. So I do think that the system is defensive in nature, that it can be programmed to ensure that it doesn't fly over Russian airspace, but we just haven't given them enough. We've given them a false sense of security with it.
This Patriot system, it's complicated. It needs a lot of training, typically 6 months. It's being sped up in this case to just 2 months. I mean, is it also too late that it's being sent?
Not, it might be. We're likely training their soldiers now in third world countries, reports are showing, and using training simulations. But it is complex. It has a fire direction system which calculates the firing solutions, well-advanced radar which can pick up multiple targets at one time. So it is complex. It's not a video game. I think that is the other concern, that if we were going to do this, again, from a strategic perspective, we should have done it months ago and had it in place for the wintertime.
Are you concerned at all that, you know, as Russia has said, they've described it as an escalatory step, even though the administration and you have described this as a defensive system? Are you worried that just providing the Patriot system could escalate Russia's war?
It can, but as what's happening now on the ground is the Ukraine military is literally destroying Russia's conventional forces, and something we just didn't expect 300 days into the war at this point. So it gets back to what's Russia's response going to be. It'll have to be strategic, and it'll have to really start. It'll tripwire something that they probably can't imagine or can't control. So if they had a way that they could respond tactically, perhaps that would be the case. I just don't think that they have that. So I'm not necessarily worried about this escalating it from their perspective, just from air defense systems. There are other things we could do clearly that they would think would be escalatory.
You mentioned just in the few seconds we have left that the Ukrainian forces have done well in the face of Russia's military, and the Patriot system might provide a false sense of security. What kind of aid should the U.S. be delivering in this moment?
Well, I think the United States has got to look at what we can do to help them take the Black Sea forces out in Crimea, offensive weapons on the ground, perhaps missile systems that will allow them to go on the offensive. That's going to be the difference. I think we're waiting to see winter and see how winter goes for them.
Retired U.S. Army Major Mike Lyons, thanks so much for your time. Happy holidays.
Thanks for having me.
Some of the country's coldest temperatures this week have been in Montana. We're talking close to 50 degrees below zero, with biting winds that made it feel even colder. It's a dangerous place to be homeless, as Austin Amistoy with Montana Public Radio reports.
One of the state's biggest homeless shelters is the Pavarello Center in Missoula, where Joe Bonney is in charge.
It seems strange to say I hope that we are at capacity, but if that's how many people need shelter, then I hope we're at capacity.
Bonney says 28 people died while homeless in Missoula this year. That's a few more than in previous years. They're proud that none of the deaths were cold-related. The annual ceremony memorializing deaths of people without housing in the capital city, Helena, is usually held outdoors. This year, it was moved inside the state capitol rotunda as the temperature plunged to 29 degrees below zero. Helena's Symphony Orchestra played a Jewish musical meditation for mourning. Jennifer Gursky with YWCA Helena led the ceremony.
Tonight, as we gather in our people's house, there are some of our neighbors struggling to simply keep their fingers and toes warm, struggling to know where their next gallon of gas is coming from, and wondering if they fall asleep under their blankets, if they will wake up.
Organizations in many Montana cities and towns have opened special shelters or warming centers this week to try to save people's lives. Some are offering hotel vouchers and discouraging people from sleeping in their cars. The organization that runs Bozeman's largest warming shelter is scrambling to stay open 24 hours a day during this cold snap.
You know, we are doing what it takes right now to shift funding to be able to do this. But as we all know, our winters here are long.
For NPR News, I'm Austin Amistoy in Missoula, Montana.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. Good morning, it's 8:19. Later this hour, we'll have Wisconsin Life. We'll hear a story from Eau Claire, where one set of parents went to great lengths to find one particular bear for their son just in time for the holidays. It's a story about holiday magic coming up in 25 minutes here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Explore how lasers can help combat cancer and how soil can lead to the discovery of new antibiotics in PBS Wisconsin Education's newest resource, Meet the Lab, an online collection of educational resources for middle school science classrooms. funded in part through the Timothy William Trout Education Fund. The full collection is available for free use by teachers, educators, and families at pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR and its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
In weather today, a blizzard is expected across much of the state, at least blizzard-like conditions, with 50-mile-per-hour wind gusts, wind chills ranging from 40 below in the north to 20 below in the south throughout the day. That cold wind and cold temperatures expected to continue on Christmas Eve tomorrow and Christmas Day on Sunday before finally starting to warm up next week. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investments in securities involve the risk of loss. And from Bed Bath & Beyond, with cleaning products too, featuring a curated selection of brands like Dyson, KitchenAid, and UGG. More at bedbathandbeyond.com. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel. Screening tests like mammograms and colonoscopies can catch certain cancers early. But for most deadly cancers, there are no screening tests. Research is underway to develop a simple blood test that could screen for multiple kinds of cancer at once. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, some people are already getting this kind of cancer screening by accident.
When Kathleen Oxtokolnis was expecting her first child, she got a prenatal test that's become pretty routine. The test takes a sample of a pregnant person's blood, and it looks for bits of free-floating DNA. Some of this DNA is released by cells in the placenta. That means it can be used to screen the pregnancy for chromosomal abnormalities like Down syndrome. It can also reveal the baby's sex. Oxtokolnis says all her friends who had babies had gotten this test.
They're like, oh, it's so exciting. You're going to find out, you know, all these different things from it.
The first time she took the test, a nurse called back later and said there'd been some error. The results were inconclusive. So she got her blood drawn again, and again, the results came back inconclusive. Her nurse midwife said, I don't know what this means.
So she just said, like, this is a result that's extremely rare, and that I was the first example of someone in their practice having ever had this case.
The nurse midwife suggested that Oxtokolnis and her husband speak to a genetic counselor. At that point, she says,
I was more worried about the baby. I wasn't thinking anything about myself really at all.
But the counselor explained that the free-floating DNA is actually a mixture. Some reflects the genetic makeup of the fetus, but even more of that DNA comes from the pregnant person's own cells. And if some of those cells are cancerous, that can actually mess with the results of this test.
So that was like really difficult to wrap my head around. I wasn't expecting to hear anything about myself.
Actually, though, there's a huge amount of research going on right now on using cell-free DNA to screen the blood for multiple kinds of cancer at once. President Biden's cancer moonshot has made the development of this kind of cancer screening a priority, as he noted in a recent speech.
Imagine simple blood test during an annual physical that could detect cancer early, where the chances of cure are best.
That's the goal. But even though some of these tests do seem technically good at detecting DNA from cancerous cells, there's no definitive evidence yet that this information can be used to benefit people's health.
We don't know, in fact, that they truly will pick up those cancers in a time frame where when you intervene, when you do something after that test to that patient, it makes a difference.
That's Lori Manassian, Deputy Director for Cancer Prevention at the National Cancer Institute. Her agency is currently organizing a huge clinical trial for multi-cancer detection tests that will enroll 24,000 people and eventually may expand to over 200,000 to see if using them to screen can truly help.
There's so much we don't know about this. We need to do the trials so we can get the information.
In the meantime, it just wasn't clear what Oxtecolnis should do. Her counselor told her that there was one small clinical trial for pregnant folks like her, whose inconclusive test results might mean a cancer somewhere in the body was releasing DNA into the blood. One of the people who started this study is Diana Bianchi. She's head of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development.
We want to be able to tell them what to do with these results, both the healthcare providers and the patients.
Her plan was to bring pregnant people to the clinical center at the National Institutes of Health, give them free full-body MRI scans, and an exhaustive blood workup.
Everyone thought we were a little crazy at the beginning, that it's going to be so hard to recruit people, and there's no way these healthy women are going to have cancer.
Because, keep in mind, the people in this study got the testing not to be screened for cancer, but because they were intending to learn about a pregnancy. So they're all fairly young and seemingly healthy. Amy Turiff is a genetic counselor at NIH.
I think to the average person, if you have cancer, you don't feel well, you have some lump, bump, some sort of scary symptom, and that's just not the experience of the people who are being referred to us.
She says that's why, in the end, they often choose not to participate in the study. Bianchi says those that do often end up getting troubling news.
Over half of them do have a tumor. So this is not a trivial finding. This really needs to be taken seriously.
She says all kinds of cancers have been detected. Rectal cancer, rare, once-in-a-million tumors. Oxtecolnis decided to go to the NIH Clinical Center with her husband, but she didn't really think anything was wrong.
There could be some sort of like weird thing that pops up on there that's benign that just happens to like trigger this type of result. Like there were other things that it could be.
She let them draw numerous vials of blood. She spent over an hour in an MRI machine. At the end of the day, a team of doctors sat her down and said she had masses in her neck and chest that looked like lymphoma.
I was like, lymphoma? Like, what's lymphoma? Hearing that news that you have cancer is just like, it's hard to describe. It's just such like an overwhelming experience.
Especially because she was pregnant.
Your emotions are kind of all over the place. And it was like definitely really difficult in the time.
She underwent chemotherapy while pregnant, something that can be done safely, and she eventually had a healthy baby girl. Since then, she's needed more treatment, including a stem cell transplant that required her to be in the hospital for almost a month this fall. Now she's just happy to be home with her family.
I'm also like incredibly grateful that I found out when I did, and then found out like I could get treatment in an early stage and that it was safe during pregnancy.
She hopes participating in that study and talking about all this will help other people understand their options when a test result unexpectedly raises the possibility of cancer. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
These days, the Nigerian artist Burna Boy fills arenas around the world. For many of his fans, especially the ones from home, it's a huge moment to see someone like him represented on the big stage.
I wanted to feel like they're seeing and hearing their own selves, their own souls.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:29 this Friday. News headlines are next from NPR, followed by state news on WPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. An Arctic front moving west to east across the U.S. is causing widespread airline flight delays and cancellations on this Friday before Christmas. Extreme cold and strong winds are gripping much of the country. Blizzard conditions remain in much of the plains and upper Midwest. In Texas, Austin and San Antonio are expecting overnight lows in the teens. French authorities say a suspect is under arrest following a deadly shooting in central Paris earlier today. At least three people were killed. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley says several others were wounded.
People have been hospitalized after the shooting mid-morning in Paris's 10th arrondissement in the busy heart of the city. The public has been urged to stay away from the area, which is completely cordoned off. Details are still emerging, but such acts of gun violence are extremely rare in France, and Parisians are stunned. While no motive for the shooting has been firmly established, Alexandre Courdebar, the mayor of the 10th arrondissement, spoke on BFM television and said the gunman had fired into a Kurdish cultural center and a restaurant. French news is now reporting that the assailant attacked migrants in Paris with a sword 1 year ago. An emergency help center for people needing psychological support has been opened at the main Paris town hall. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. The Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is launching the latest review of standards used to regulate siting and expansion of large livestock farms. As Danielle Kading reports, a committee met for the first time on Thursday.
Every 4 years, the agency must convene experts to provide technical input on standards used in the state's livestock siting law. They include things like setbacks from neighboring properties, odor, and manure storage. The agency must also review its rule for those standards. Committee member and farmer A.V. Roth says he would like more local governments to adopt livestock siting ordinances.
I'm a little disappointed that not more counties or things are enrolled in livestock siting.
Some local governments have sought more local control to regulate siting and expansion of livestock farms. Proposed updates to odor and runoff management under the last review angered farm groups and were later abandoned. Even so, GOP lawmakers cited the changes when they fired former Agriculture Secretary Brad Paff. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A Racine man faces federal charges for accessing Ring doorbell cameras around the United States and allegedly streaming live video of armed police responding to fake emergency calls. 21-year-old Kia Nelson was indicted by a federal grand jury last week for allegedly being part of a nationwide swatting spree. He and others are accused of acquiring email logins and passwords from multiple individuals and using them to access Ring devices. They're then accused of calling police, posing as children, claiming their parents were shooting guns in the house. They then allegedly live-streamed video of the law enforcement response. If convicted, Nelson faces up to 5 years in a federal prison. Governor Tony Evers has declared an energy emergency in case freezing temperature and snow leave people without heat today. Right now, there are about 1,500 people without heat or power across Wisconsin. Northern Wisconsin is expected to see more than 6 inches of snow total. Wind gusts could reach 50 miles per hour today as well. At negative 25 to 35 degrees outside, it's best advised to stay inside to avoid getting frostbite or cold-related illnesses, that according to the National Weather Service. The cold is expected to continue into Christmas. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Vicks DayQuil Severe, a daytime cold and flu medication designed to relieve up to 9 cold and flu symptoms. More at Vicks.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel. For nearly 3 years, China used extremely strict testing and lockdown policies to keep COVID out. Then it abruptly lifted nearly all those controls as a COVID surge spread across the country. Public health experts are warning the country's healthcare system could now be overwhelmed. NPR's Emily Fang joins us to talk about the outbreak. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
So, Emily, what are things like right now in China? Has the healthcare system been able to keep up with this surge?
So far, it appears yes, but barely. And that's because the surge in China is forecast to get way worse this month and into January. Anecdotally, everyone I know in Beijing has basically come down with COVID already in the last month, and it's spreading to other cities. A Shanghai hospital warned this week that half of the city's population, that's about 12.5 million people, could be infected by just the end of next week. There are long lines already outside of funeral homes and crematoria that we've visited in Beijing. Crematoria are telling us that their waiting list is now more than 1 week, which is unusual. Pharmacies in the countryside have been emptied of fever and pain medication. But the good news is that outside fever clinics and hospitals in Beijing that we visited this week is pretty busy, but it's actually pretty orderly. Unfortunately, we've seen in other pandemics that there's usually a lag of about a month after initial outbreak before we really start to see an increase in deaths and severe cases. And in China, that's supposed to happen in January.
So what are public health experts saying about how bad it could get?
Their predictions vary widely, but they're all pretty devastating. There was one model last week from the University of Hong Kong that estimates up to nearly 1 million people will die if China doesn't mount a new vaccine booster campaign. And then this month, the U.S.'s Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation predicts up to 500,000 deaths just by April if China doesn't have new travel and mask mandates. And the reason why they vary so widely is a model is only as good as the data that you put into it. And right now, there's no accurate data from China on infections. In fact, the WHO said this week that China has not released hospital data since early this month on who is coming in with COVID. For this, I talked to Ray Yip. He's an epidemiologist who founded the U.S. CDC office in China in 2003, and more recently, the China office for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
They're going to do the same thing what they did in Wuhan. In Wuhan, unless you have a confirmed PCR test, they're not going to call you a case of COVID in the beginning. So that's why the number of death in Wuhan was only 4,000. I'm sure it's at least four or five times that much. And what's happening in China right now, the death rate is probably, you know, in the thousands and every day, but they're only willing to report, you know, small handful of it.
He's referring here to the extremely strict standards that China uses to determine who dies of COVID. So strict, in fact, that officially only two people have died in this latest surge, which just does not match up with what people are going through on the ground.
So where does China go from here?
Well, it can only get worse because the real concern now is holiday travel. China has its Lunar New Year in late January, but people are already traveling home now for the holiday, and they're bringing the virus with them from cities to villages where the healthcare system is even patchier. But in China, the trend is still towards rapid, full-scale opening up. In fact, some cities like Chengdu, for example, are already reducing their quarantine requirements for inbound travelers coming from other countries. This was just simply unthinkable about a month ago when China was in the full throttle of zero COVID.
That's NPR's Emily Fang. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you so much, Leila.
In Ukraine, the date on which to celebrate Christmas is vigorously debated. Some prefer December 25th, but others celebrate it on January 7th, a tradition closely associated with Russia and the Eastern Orthodox Church. With the ongoing war, the question has taken on new meaning, as NPR's Tim Mack reports from Ukraine.
It's a foggy day with snow on the ground outside the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra, a historic Eastern Orthodox Christian site in Ukraine's capital city, founded as a cave monastery in the 11th century. The person waiting for us is Father Mykola Danilevich, a spokesperson for one of the Ukrainian Orthodox churches, which has historically had deep ties to Moscow.
What country are you from?
America.
From America, yes, yes.
We will go. The power is out in the building, the result of recent Russian strikes on energy infrastructure. In a dark room, he explains, the dispute over dates is really a dispute over calendars. Hundreds of years ago, when the West was switching from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, the Orthodox Church decided to stick with the old calendar when it came to the celebration of Christmas.
We actually celebrate the 25th of December just by the Julian calendar. And by the new calendar, it happens to be on the 7th of January.
Danilevich says that the debate over which day to celebrate Christmas has intensified since the Russian occupation of Crimea in 2014. The Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine this year has further inflamed these passions.
You know, in Ukraine now, everything is emotional. Regardless of topic, it is emotional.
Sebastian Dmitruk, a Catholic monk, met us at a religious museum in Lviv, Ukraine, where he's the director and the leader of a local congregation.
I asked them, probably 4 weeks ago, when do you want to celebrate? The whole church answered they want to celebrate 25th of December.
They felt this way despite the inconveniences it could entail.
So, at this time of war, people are even more open to speaking out. They are saying we don't want to celebrate with the Russians.
Dmitruk says he's been traveling throughout Western Ukraine over the past few days, and he's surprised about how frequently the question has been brought up.
People, even people from the small villages, want it, and they want it desperately.
Part of the division is generational and comes from the ties of long-standing tradition.
In my home, we always had this really vivid Christmas celebration.
60-year-old Alexandra Kirichuk is the assistant director of the Museum of Religion in Lviv. She has fond memories of Christmas dishes like kutia, a grain dish with gravy, and pampuk, these sweet Ukrainian pastries.
As a religious scholar, as a scientist, I understand that we need to celebrate on the 25th of December. But as an individual that is tied to those traditions that have been in my family, I won't have this sacredness on the 25th. But in January, it's something divine, mystical.
Daria Kostyuk is an 18-year-old law student who, like Kirichuk, is a Greek Catholic. But she doesn't share the same view on Christmas dates. She strongly supports celebrating on December 25th, and she says many people her age would agree with her.
I didn't want to have anything common with Russia, so that's why I want to celebrate with Europe and all world.
Still, she said, regardless of which date people choose to celebrate, she had one Christmas wish. Peace on the whole earth, and in particular, peace in Ukraine. Tim Mak, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, it's 8:42. You can make WPR a part of your holiday plans this year. In addition to festive music and features in our regular shows, we'll bring you some great holiday specials. That includes holiday favorites from WPR with host Stephanie Elkins, Christmas morning starting at 10. Learn more about all of our specials at wpr.org/holidays.
Hanukkah lights, Christmas at Luther College, and Beethoven's Missa Solemnis on Wisconsin Classical January 1st. Enjoy these festive programs now through the new year on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
The largest source of support for the WPR programs you enjoy every day comes from more than 50,000 individuals and families who contribute. You can hear your favorite program and discover new ones thanks to their investment. Find out more at WPR.org.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
Look at what's happening in news today on Morning Edition. The U.S. Senate has approved a $1.7 trillion spending package, which will keep the government open. The measure passed 68-29 and now moves on to the House of Representatives. The January 6th committee has released its final report. The 814-page document claims that former President Trump engaged in a, quote, multi-part conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election. About 2,000 Wisconsinites are without power this morning as wind speeds increase and temperatures drop across the state. Wind gusts of up to 50 miles per hour are expected across Wisconsin through the day today. Those high winds are expected to continue on Christmas Eve tomorrow. Christmas Day won't be as windy, but it'll still be cold with wind chills below zero all day. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Paramount Pictures with Babylon. In a world without rules, how far would you go for your dreams? Starring Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie, and Diego Calva, now playing in theaters. This film is rated R. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about holiday magic.
Parents will go to great lengths to make sure that their kids have the perfect Christmas. Parents like Jan Larson of Eau Claire, who tells us about the quest she went on to find a particular bear for her son.
Mom, Dad, our youngest son, Dana's plaintive words travel from his bedroom down the hall and into the kitchen. I can't find Peef. These words are not particularly alarming on a clear summer day. As the ward of a loving but adventurous four-year-old, Peef might have burrowed under the covers for another 40 winks. Perhaps he has tucked himself behind the living room couch to initiate a favorite game of hide and seek. Or Peef could have retreated to the reading loft, where Dana will find him patiently waiting among the books and toys the two so often share together. For Peef is a magic bear whose fur is cut from cloth, and anywhere that Dana goes, well, Peef is sure to follow. I turn to assure the dark brown eyes filled with concern standing before me. Honey, don't worry, we'll find him. What I don't know is just how far Peef has gone and how far I will need to go to keep my promise. Peef is the progeny of two Christmas books. In book one, a lonely Santa makes Peef from the elves' favorite scraps of fabric. Peef is his constant companion, joining him on his sleigh to deliver toys every Christmas Eve. But by book two, Peef is doubting his purpose. He longs to join the other toys in their journey to the arms of a loving girl or boy. And so, on one snowy Christmas Eve, Santa bids Peef a tender goodbye and chooses one special little boy to love and cherish Peef forever. Dana knows he is that boy. He showers Peef with all the love and attention due a magic Christmas bear. They are now the constant companions, taking trips to the park, to the library, and to Grandma and Grandpa's house. But on this morning, and many mornings for weeks to follow, Peef is not burrowed under the covers, or tucked behind the couch, or waiting in the loft for his boy. My husband Lorne and I brace for the grief we feel sure will develop, and talk about ways to distract Dana. In the end, Dana comes up with his own coping mechanism. Peef, he announces some weeks after the bear's departure, is not lost. He missed Santa and went back to the North Pole for a visit. He'll be home for Christmas. Dana's storyline continues into late summer and early fall. He wonders aloud at what toys Peef and Santa might be creating in the workshop. Our parental strategy of waiting for Dana to forget Peef is not working. Our son's persistent narrative and innocent hope sends me searching. Could Peef be home for Christmas? I call vendors in Connecticut, scour eBay and collectors' websites, and tap into my mom network. It is December 23rd. I sit staring at the lights of the Christmas tree, hoping for inspiration. The books. I rummage through our collection of Christmas tales spread beneath the tree until I find what I need. I flip open the back cover. The author is from Minnesota. I snap open my laptop. A few clicks later, and I have him. A few more, and a number. Hello? You don't know me, but... The words come in a rush. I tell Tom Hegg, the man whose imagination has created Dana's dearest companion, of my search. When I finish, I can hear the smile behind his voice. Which one? I have boxes of them in the garage. Waves of relief wash over me. A full description of Peef guarantees he is just right. Via overnight express, Peef is coming home. I hide the box in our bedroom. Now home, how should Peef make his entrance? It is Lauren's idea. We tuck our youngest into bed and wait until his breaths are slow and deep. We nestle Peef into Dana's arms. It is the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature is stirring as the Larsons dream the sweetest of dreams. We wake to Christmas joy. Mom! Dad! Dana shouts with glee. It's Peef! He's back! And he's grown!
Jan Larson is a professor emeritus from the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
Is brought to you by WPR and NAMI Wisconsin, the state organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Wisconsin Badgers men's basketball team will not play Grambling State today. That game's been canceled due to weather. The women's basketball game against Valparaiso was postponed yesterday, but they say they'll make that up. The Milwaukee Bucks are taking on the Brooklyn Nets tonight at 6:30. The Bucks will also be playing on Christmas Day, taking on the Boston Celtics. The Packers play Christmas Day as well, taking on the Miami Dolphins. Blizzard conditions across much of Wisconsin today with wind chills well below zero. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin. So it's hard to believe, but it's been 30 years since we first met Crumpet the Elf. Crumpet is the alter ego of writer and humorist David Sedaris. In 1992, here on Morning Edition, Sedaris read excerpts from his Santaland Diaries, an offbeat take on the holidays from the perspective of a Macy's department store elf. That essay helped launch David Sedaris' career as playwright and humorist. It was also the beginning of a Morning Edition holiday tradition. So here, once again, is David Sedaris as Crumpet.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa." Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. 22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting in magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. And she said, "I'm going to have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? "I'm going to have you fired," and I want to lean over and say, "I'm going to have you killed." The overall cutest elf is a fella from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children. sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, this flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden, we were surrounded by five Santas and three other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on, elves and Santas. This morning, I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, "This way out of Santa Land." A woman was standing at one of the cash registers, paying for her pictures while her son lay beneath her, kicking and heaving, having a tantrum. The woman said, "Riley, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for." The child said, "He is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me." The woman grabbed my arm and said, "You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas." I said that Santa changed his policy and no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. The woman got a worried look on her face and said, "All right, that's enough." I said, "He's going to take your car and your furniture and all of your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing." The mother said, "No, that's enough. Really." This afternoon, I was stuck being photo elf for Santa Santa. Santa Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He'll talk to them and give a hearty chuckle and ring his bells, and then he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol. Santa then asks if they'll sing it for him. The children are shy and don't want to sing out loud, so Santa Santa says, "Oh, little elf, help young Brenda here sing that favorite carol of hers." Late in the afternoon, a child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was. Santa Santa suggested "Away in a Manger." The girl agreed to it, but didn't want to sing because she didn't know the words. Santa Santa said, "Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us." It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I sang it the way Billie Holiday might have sang if she'd put out a Christmas album. "Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head." Santa Santa did not allow me to finish. This evening I was sent to be a photo elf. Once a child starts crying, it's all over. The parents had planned to send these pictures as cards or store them away until the child is grown and can lie, claiming to remember the experience. Tonight I saw a woman slap and shake her crying child. She yelled, "Rachel, get on that man's lap and smile or I'll give you something to cry about." Then she sat Rachel on Santa's lap and I took the picture, which supposedly means, on paper, that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be, that everything is snowy and wonderful. It's not about the child or Santa or Christmas or anything, but the parents' idea of a world they cannot make work for them.
David Sedaris reading from his essay, The Santaland Diaries, first heard on this program 30 years ago. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. Wishing you a Merry Christmas. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Alex Crowe. Special thanks to John Davis, who helps bring us the news each morning. You can hear Morning Edition each weekday from 5 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Glass Nickel Pizza, 25 years of employee-inspired pizzas made from scratch at 9 Wisconsin locations. Dedicated to hiring people who love laughs, fun, and pizza. GlassNickelPizza.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Matheson Memorial Library in Elkhorn will start its monthly matinees at Matheson with free movies and popcorn. January kicks off a classic remake of West Side Story. For more info, contact 262-723-2678.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.